This is Increment Vice. The podcast that explores Paul Thomas Anderson's inherent vice, one scene at a time, with your host, Travis Woods. 42 episodes down, 4 more to go. We're at the end now, friends, staring at the sea of time, the sea of memory and forgetfulness, waiting for what happens to everything to happen to us too, an ending. And so it's endings we're thinking about today, for the show, for the movie, for the American fate we're all held hostage to. Jeez. Remember when we used to have fun on this thing?
There's a line in today's scene, one that comes directly from Thomas Pynchon's novel. It goes like this. May we trust that this blessed ship is bound for some better shore, risen and redeemed, where the American fate mercifully failed to transpire. Where the American fate mercifully failed to transpire. The American fate. That's a notion I've been thinking a lot about lately, and I assume you probably are too. The American fate. What it is, where it's going, and what happens to all of us who live on the land of that fate, a fate which may be permanently cemented one way or another come November 3rd of this year. It all feels very much as if we are coming to the end of something, either the end of something bad or the end of the last gasp and end of something good. So with that heaviness in mind, it's that mood of endings that seems kind of appropriate, seeing as how we are coming to the end of Inherent Vice and the end of this show. Inherent Vice is the story of endings. Or how they happen. Does it ever end? Sortilege muses early on. Of course it does. It did. So I'm thinking a lot about endings tonight. And it's that idea of endings, that thread of endings, that today's guest picked up on early in his review of Vice upon the film's theatrical release. And he captured it thusly. There's a lot swirling around in writer-director Paul Thomas Anderson's hilarious, freewheeling adaptation of the allegedly unadaptable Pynchon's 2009 psychedelic noir. Maybe too much to absorb in a single viewing. But endings are important here, and I think the key to best appreciating this stubbornly singular entertainment is to view these characters as the last men on the field, still playing a game they're achingly slow to learn is already over. That's a hell of a mood and a hell of a line. And the man who wrote it is sitting here with us tonight, a fucking fantastic writer and film critic with bylines, Cat's Cradling from The Village Voice to Time Out New York to Movie Mezzanine to RogerEbert.com to the Boston Herald, as well as a veteran guest of my internet husband, Blake Howard's One Heat Minute Productions podcasts, of which Increment Vice is one, and thus we contractually cannot end this show without at least one appearance from the man. So with that in mind, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to Increment Vice, Mr. Sean Burns.
Ah, shucks. You guys are the best.
Aren't we, though? We're pretty good. We're all right. How are you? How are you tonight? It seems like a stupid question. All right, off the bat, I feel like it's a stupid question to ask in the middle of a 2020 election cycle with a global viral pandemic.
I was actually in a really good mood until you started talking.
Yeah. I'm still kind of hung over from that last episode, I think. So you're going to have to blame Chad for that. But I don't know. It's kind of hard not to be thinking of endings right now. The movie's ending, the show is ending, and a lot of things out in the world seem to be coming to one end or another. It's I don't know about you. I know you came here for laughs, for lots of tomfoolery and hijinks. But yeah, I'm thinking about endings tonight. I don't know about you.
But the one comforting thing you can look at is that there are all these feelings going on in something set 50 years ago.
That's very true. That's very Very true. Look, kind of a cockeyed optimist there. To quote.
Well, every once in a while, Kramer. I try to think of that scene in No Country for Old Men when the, you know, the guy's telling Tommy Lee Jones like, "This shit ain't new."
Yeah, that's a very good point. That's a, and yet, as I,
how much of it really is our generational narcissism? We have to be like, the ending's on our watch. Like,
we're diving in. We've talked about this on the show. Is I think what makes this story so powerful is not that it is prophetic. It is simply indicating that nothing has changed, except maybe get a little grimmer, and that whatever kind of cancerous rot was already into the marrow. And the DNA of things, of America, of the American fate, in 1970, it has only gotten worse. And 50 years later, here we are kind of reckoning with it in real time. But, you know, hey. It seemed easier
to get laid back then, you're right.
it was a more innocent time. But, hey, if you want to follow the thinking of notorious optimist Cormac McCarthy, and just think that, you know, America's going to be A-okay. You know, you're probably sleeping better at night than I am. But yeah, the American fate, that's the line from this scene. And that's kind of the through line for me of this moment of this episode, I guess. And here it feels like we're standing on the shore of it with clumps of it breaking off into the sea and hopefully not going to take us with it. Hopefully it's just going to take the bad things. But yeah, boy, wow. I did kind of start with a downer, didn't I? I did bring you down from the get-go. We were all giggles and hugs at the beginning of this thing off air, and now I just I'm dabbing tears away. But we're not going to get to this scene yet, but I don't know how we can be super jovial about this moment. That's going to be on you to bring. You're going to be the superhero that's going to save this episode and keep me from bawling like last time. That's on you. It's on you. That's on your show.
Well, again, in terms of like how cyclical things are, like, you know, remember like the moment, the scene we're talking about does have the attorney played by Benicio del Toro, which is just his job now. And these sort of.
Yeah, I really hope to get a trilogy at some point of like one more end of an era, elegiac monument to the 1960s in which he plays a very difficult to understand lawyer who provides exposition to our stoner hero.
It's a, really it's a bad lawyer too.
Yeah, just not a good lawyer at all. Dr. Gonzo, just not the most reliable source of information, and nor does Sancho Smilex seem to be the most adept and adroit navigator of maritime law in the whole wide world. But you know, bless him for trying. But before we start getting into the weeds, we're going to do what we always do, which is we kick things off by talking about how people felt about the film the first time out. And I think going from your review and some of the things I've seen you write online, that you're one of the few folks who actually loved this thing from the jump, or at least really liked it.
Yeah, I'll tell you, it was funny. The I saw it a few times, three times before I wrote about it. I saw it in the 2 months between seeing it and writing about it. A friend had gotten an early copy, who was in a critics group. And so I get this weird thing with weed, right? I'll try it like, I used to try it like once a year. I go, oh yeah, I don't like this. So my friend who had gotten the copy of the movie was, he was selling drugs to support his film criticism habit. And he was like famous around town for having really great shit. And I was like, well, we've got Inherent Vice a month before it comes out. Let's do this properly. It's been about a year. This time it'll be different. Travis, it's never different. It's
Isn't that the point of the movie?
So, you know, I got way too into my head. Like I start I know people get stoned and they're stupid and they laugh like Beavis and Butthead and everything. So they've got this sense of relaxation and well-being. And I have the exact opposite. I'm just turning things over like crazy. So sort of the perfect way to receive the film for the first time.
Sure.
Where, you know, I think I was following the plot, which I never have since. And I absolutely understood it perfectly. And the way I never have again. And Yeah, I don't think I've ever actually smoked again after that. I figured out what it is with weed now. They're too good at it now. Like, if you could still buy the shit my friends and I smoked in high school, like the really crappy stuff, like, that would be okay. Like, I could function on that.
You want it stepped on a little bit.
Yeah, I want the garbage.
Well, that's
experts growing things. It's become a science, and now I mean, it's just impossible. I can't conduct myself as a human on that.
So I'm going to take that very Vicean digression to be your way of saying, yes, I enjoyed the movie the first time out.
Oh, very much. Yeah. I was tweeting that night that if Josh Brolin didn't win the Oscar, I was never going to watch it again.
Right. I mean, I know it's a film that I think no one understood. So I mean, no one's getting nominated for a performance in that film, but if anyone should have been, it should have been Brolin. And I will beat that drum forever and ever and ever. I do think that man deserves an Oscar, and I think he deserves an Oscar for his performance as Detective Christian F. Bigfoot Bjornsson in this film. He's doing so much with a role that is on the page, was literally designed by PTA to be nothing but a kind of monosyllabic foil, that he was just meant to be someone that was there to impede Doc in his journey. And that, according to Brolin really fought PTA every step of the way to expand that character's role and make him more melancholic, make him sadder, give him weirder shit to do. Let him be blowing a banana whenever you see him. Let him always be trying to consume something and gain something from that consumption. Like, that's all Brolin.
Well, it's fascinating to me. I don't think the movie works without Brolin being the melancholic heart of it. You know, I mean, he was... If he was just an impediment, it wouldn't, like, he's this heartbroken. This is the guy who gave everything to the straight world.
Yeah.
He did everything you're supposed to do.
And he's still miserable. He still lost the inherent vice of life. He was still unable to insure against inherent vice. He played by all the rules. He married a woman instead of Vincent and Delicato, his partner. He had a kid. He flew the straight and narrow. He beat up hippies and long hairs. But still, no Cielo Drive for Bigfoot. No movie, no TV.
No Cielo Drive for Bigfoot. And it's great. Like, look at his wife. Like, you never see her face. Like, her head's cut off, like Charlie Brown's teacher, which is screaming at him.
I ask you for one fucking night a week, Christian.
Christian and Chastity. His wife's name is
Christian and Chastity.
How great is that marriage going?
But you're right. But that's something that's so interesting about the film, especially on the page. But that is something I think that, and we've talked about this previously on the show, that kind of post Punch Drunk Love PTA scripts are almost they're almost skeletal in what is not it based on what is not there. There is so much not on the page in those films or in those scripts. And I think that is because he's trusting himself more and more just to discover things on the day and discover things in the filmmaking. And, you know, I think one of the things that makes him such an interesting and fantastic director is that he does trust his actors. Like, by all accounts, according to each of them, they always, in any interview they give during a press cycle for a movie, they say he trusts us to figure this stuff out. Like, he doesn't give us, like, you know, here's your mixtape. This is all the stuff that your character would listen to. And here's your 15-page backstory. Like, he just says, go figure this out for yourself and bring it back to me. And he trusted them to do that. And he trusted that Brolin would know what to do. And Brolin came back saying, this isn't the character. This is a black and white dragnet guy. And I want this to be a character. I want this to be someone real. And you're right. I think that, that's why I think ultimately, even though he's not in this scene, we're going to talk about him. He looms over it because we're going to see him in the next scene. He looms over it. But without Brolin making those choices, I think you're right. I think a lot of the movie kind of falls apart in that he is a necessary mirror to everything that Doc does, because he's amplifying and underlining, everything that Doc is going through, but won't actively talk about in the movie. That Bigfoot is kind of his weird, bizarre Greek chorus following him around, echoing all of his thoughts. Mm-hmm. Plus, he just looks cool with a flat top.
Because, I mean, it's been since he started the rap with Anderson. He was always, you know, wanted to be Altman and even understudied Altman on Pretty Home Companion. But I feel like Inherent Vice is when he went full Altman with this one. not just because there's so many parallels to The Long Goodbye, but it really feels like this is when he let go. And Altman would do the thing where he made the movie that he found. You know,
yeah.
Things planned out. And, you know, I mean, I hate when people say he improvised on that day and that's what, you know, it was just an accident that he kicked. You know, the shit was planned out. It was directed.
Sure.
But he was willing to go wherever the movie, wherever it was happening that day led him. And it feels like, because if you look at, especially like There Will Be Blood and The Master, those, they're great movies, but they're very clenched.
Yeah.
Even if they're not as pyrotechnically worked out as Boogie Nights and Magnolia, they're still like, I am making a goddamn masterpiece. you can feel the effort. Like, I mean, those movies are willed into being.
Right? Yeah.
Inherent Vice feels like he just caught it. And that's where the scene went.
Exactly. You know, I get what you mean. You know, clinched versus, say, those earlier films that feel, and this is not a criticism because I love them, but they feel diagrammed within an inch of their life. You know that every single moment, every single breath is storyboarded. And yeah, everything.
Magnolia is my favorite of all of his movies, but I mean that's diagrammed down to the last.
Yeah, I mean, page. I mean, I love that story of I've mentioned this before as well. I love that story when he signed to make Boogie Nights, and he literally came in and slapped the script on the table, and insisted before signing the contract that we are going to look at every single page, and you're going to agree to every single page because we are filming this as is, and we're cutting nothing. So you need to know that this is the movie you're getting. And I think
of like Macy on the Magnolia documentary where Macy's smoking a cigarette. He's like, yeah, he ground the lenses himself, developed the film in his bathtub.
But I think you are right in the Altman connection in that, you know, it's easy to say, yeah, well, it's kind of like It's a Long Goodbye because it's, you know, it's a hazy, lazy detective stoner movie. But for me, what feels so Altman-esque about this is, as you said, yes, it's a film, so it's pre-planned. You know, deals are made months in advance. They know what they're shooting. They know where they're going on the day, for the most part. They know what scene they're going to catch today. Everyone's learned their lines. They've got their sides, everything like that. But there is also very much a feeling of, we're just going to let the movie be the movie. Like, we're not going to corral this thing. We're just going to try and catch what we can catch, and hopefully it all works out. And while to some degree, I think that's every film, there is something decidedly Altman-esque about that idea of, look, we'll just let it be its own. Let the movie be its own thing. We'll let it be what it is, and we're not going to try and hem it in and direct it. We'll look at what we have. We'll put it together, and we're not going to try and fix it. We're not going to try and change it. We're going to change it. We're not going to change it in post. It is what it is, and that feels very Altman-esque to me. That it's that that ramshackle trust that, and also kind of David Lynchian in a way, the trust that the movie will become what the movie wants to be. On some level, you have to trust that the movie is going to be what it needs to be and keep your hands off a little bit. And as much as you can, I don't think you can call PTA a hands-off director, but it gives the film a hands-off feeling. Like there's no one holding onto the reins of this thing. It's going to go where it wants to go. And that is, I know some people find that incredibly aggravating about Altman and incredibly aggravating about this film, but it's one of the things that I love about this film, because even someone like me, you can watch it. I've watched it so many goddamn times. It still feels unpredictable. There are still moments where a scene will come up and I'll be like, oh shit, I forgot this scene comes after Bigfoot does that thing with the banana. I forgot about this. Yeah. I love this. I totally forgot. This is where the movie goes for 5 minutes after that. And I think that kind of gets baked into the film when you make it like that kind of haphazard Altman-esque way, which I absolutely adore, at least in Inherent Vice. When every film is made that way, I mean, I like a lot of Altman's work, but that at a certain point, I do tap out because it's just, you can only trust the movie to be the movie so many times. But doing it once with Inherent Vice,
he didn't make any small mistakes, Altman. You know,
that's a good way. That's right, and that's why I'm glad that PTA kind of only did it the one time before going, yeah, that's, I got that, I got my yayas out, I got.
There's a weird thing with Anderson though, because I mean, I've been following from one of the people. I saw Hard Eight before Boogie Nights came out even, so I have a long history with him. But I've been saying since 1999, like when this kid, I was calling him a kid, I don't know, I'm 10 years, like 5 years younger than him, I still call him, you know, he was the kid back then. So, but I was like, when he makes a bad movie, it is going to be the worst fucking movie you have ever seen. Because he is flying, and I've been saying this for over 20 years now, he still hasn't made one, but you know, you get that feeling like he is flying like totally on instruments here. There's no help from anyone. The movies are exactly what he wants them to be. They come out of his own head, and he's not answerable to anybody. And when he finally screws up, it's going to be amazing.
You know, I love his work as you do. I mean, he's just a filmmaker whom I adore, obviously. I kind of do want to see what that movie would be, just out of morbid curiosity, because you can give it this, it wouldn't be boring. There's bad movies that are bad because they are boring. And then there are bad movies that are bad because on just a genetic level, they just, every single cell seems to be infused with just what the fuckery. And those movies are kind of interesting. And like, I'm still, you know, we have a running joke on the show, you know, the divide PTA's career by Coke Kid or Reed Dad, directorial modes. I kind of really want to see the coked out of his mind crashing right into a goddamn wall PTA movie where he just loses his goddamn mind and hubris and decides to make like his 4-hour hyper Scorsese like gangster epic or something like that. I don't think we're ever going to see that film from him. No, I think he's too controlled the filmmaker. I think he's a smart enough guy before he kicks a movie off. He knows that he's got something special. But I would, yeah.
You know, like two degrees off Magnolia would have been that, though. It just happened that everything worked.
That's Magnolia was one more indulgence away from not working. One indulgence away from
that is such a. I saw it again recently for the first time in years. I saw it in a 35 print. It was a Julianne Moore tribute at this theater, and she was there for the reception and everything. But you're watching that again, it's like, how is this still working?
Here's our first of many digressions. That movie should not work on any conceivable level. A 3-hour misery porn drama in which everyone has been broken by their parents or their lovers or their children. There is a sing-along. No one is happy. No one is happy except for the final 30 seconds of that goddamn movie. Does anyone smile with true joy?
Just the first 2 hours are pitched like that. Like, I mean, it's just steamrolling at that level.
It's it's the equivalent of someone just yelling in your face how bad life gets. Oh, and throw in a lot of cancer, child abuse, a single.
The camera never stops moving. The score never stops. You're just going down these hallways.
a sing-along. It's all set in like a 3-block triangle of the valley. Oh, and by the way, God shows up and just starts hurling fucking frogs at people to solve all their problems.
And nobody mentions it. Like,
and it's just kind of like a thing.
They're just wiping the frogs off the car. Like, oh, well, here we go.
What's amazing is when you describe Magnolia, you are describing the Icarus flying too close to the sun hubris movie. That is the movie that crashes in the wall. It should not work. And it is a testament to that man's goddamn energy and conviction that you watch that movie and it, you can talk about it now and we can go, okay, yeah, you know, it's a little much. Or as he says in the documentary about the making of, and Fiona Apple is pretending to be the movie and he's pretending to be an executive yelling at
it's
her.
So adorable.
He's like, you need to be shorter. Don't be as long. You're too sad and you're too miserable. You're just too much fucking too. And I love that line. That's such
F-words a great way. And your cancer and your frog.
Yeah. But that's such a great way to describe Magnolia is you're just too much fucking too. There's just too much twos in there. And yet we describe it. We talk about it and we're like, yeah, that's a terrible movie. That's a terrible idea for a movie. But then when you sit down, you watch it, you are enthralled because this is amazing. This is, if, you know, Ebert called movies empathy machines, and I think they are, but I think that they also act as catharsis machines. You go in for 2 hours, or in this case, 3 hours, you essentially pay for an emotional catharsis that sometimes you never get in life. And he just basically created a three hour catharsis machine. He's like, hey, have you ever been upset at your parents? Have you ever been abused? Have you ever known someone with cancer? Do you have cancer? Do you have problems with God? Do you have problems with your career? Do you have problems with love? Do you feel like you aren't worth anything? We've got something here to make you feel better by the end. And on top of it, we'll sing it to you. If you miss it, we'll sing the message to you. And then God is going to show up. So, hey, God exists. So you got that going for you too.
Here's Tom Cruise to take
And here's Tom Cruise with a glorious haircut acting his ass off in a way that maybe you forgot he could do. It's amazing. It's amazing. It's too much fucking too, but it's amazing. And that actually brings me to something that I wanted to ask you about, that too much fucking too, which is you love Inherent Vice. I love Inherent Vice, but I'm always trying to like suss out what is it about this movie that makes it a movie that needs a podcast. Well, not that it needs, it's doing just fine on its own, but like that you gave me the feeling this movie needs to be defended. I need to talk about this movie ad nauseum so people can really hear about what a masterpiece this actually is. And so I'm always thinking about why didn't more people like this movie? Why didn't they dig it? And to talk about that idea of too much fucking too, you noted something interesting in your review, that line about maybe there's too much to absorb in a single viewing of this thing, which I don't know. I feel like there's enough for you to grasp onto that first time to get it, but I think a lot of people disagree. And given how difficult Vice seems to be, with at least 80% of the population who saw it and gave it a spin, do you think that that's actually part of the problem, that there is simply too much to absorb? And I get that that's Pynchon's style, that level of density, that metric density in his work. But do you, as you put it, do you feel that perhaps this story was unadaptable and that it is just too much fucking too for people?
Well, my thing is I always don't really give a shit about plot. Like, I mean, I don't know if you notice my reviews, I'll spend like a paragraph on the plot at the most. And I honestly don't really follow the plot of movies while I'm watching them very well. Like, it's just a series of stuff that happens, but I'm looking at other things. And
really quick,
like, more boring to me than people who pick out plot holes.
I have to ask something really quick before we go any further, because a lot of people have said that. They're like, well, I don't really hang on to the plot. Now, I mean, I'm a film noir guy. I totally get the thing about how you can't live and die for a plot, especially in a noir film. You know, you look at something like The Big Sleep, that makes no fucking sense whatsoever. Oh. On any level, all you need to know is detective, good guy, sisters,
never
maybe good, maybe really bad. Say that again.
It's never bothered me that The Big Sleep makes no sense.
But when people say in general, I don't follow the plot, this is just a general question for me. What is it that you think is going on in a movie if you're not following the plot? Like, what do you think is happening?
There's enough pointing in the direction. I mean, that's why I don't like so many like current movies, because they keep repeating the plot to you over and over again. And I'm like, I don't care. I mean, that's like my beef with Christopher Nolan, where he won't stop explaining things to me. And I'm like, just roll with it, brother. Fine. Just, you know, walk up the walls. I don't care.
The exposition. God, the goddamn exposition.
Like, I hate exposition, so I don't. You know, I mean, you look at the old noirs are the perfect thing. Like, you know, you have the camera pointed in the right direction. You say, I knew it all along. And you're smoking. You're like, okay, I'm not going to think about it any further. Yeah. I am so divorced from this reality. There's like a podcast around here in Boston these guys do, where they just like, they pick apart like spoilers and plot, and they don't talk about filmmaking. They don't talk about performances. It's just, they are so obsessed with plot, and I'm like, how there could be no duller way to engage with a film. I don't really like a lot of these long serialized television shows, to me, because they just seem like plot delivery devices.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of atmosphere. There's not a lot of aesthetics or things I enjoy. Especially the first time I saw Inherent Vice, being so zonked, like I didn't have to try to pretend to even grapple onto anything. You know, it's just like, hey, here we go. Here's a bunch of fun scenes.
But do you think on some level there is too much fucking too? And I'm not just talking about the plot, because
there's way too many scenes of people talking about people you don't know who they're talking about.
Yeah,
everybody in the movie has a cuckoo banana's name.
Well, that's pure Pynchon. That's but again, is that is kind of the question. Is it that, you know, is Inherent Vice in some ways, does it have that kind of the Lolita disease, in that there is just so goddamn much in Lolita, the novel, that if you adapt it, you're only able to adapt a part of it. Like, you know, Kubrick took it and he ran with the lyrical wit and the scathing satire of it. Adrian Lin, you know, basically took any level of sex he could, along with some melancholy. And he went and he made that.
Well, he did the tragedy and Kubrick did the comedy. Like,
but the thing is, when you read the book is all of those things.
Right. Well, it's the greatest book ever written. I know that'll get me banned from all the lady bookshelf police on Twitter, but.
Well, it is. It's the greatest English language book ever written. Yeah. That said, sometimes I wonder if Inherent Vice is that for the normies out there, in that there's just not enough of a whole story, and this sliver of kind of slapstick melancholy romanticism that PTA gives us, is it both not enough of the whole story but also too much fucking too of the threads?
It's probably there's probably too much Data in the movie. I mean, I love the movie. I think you could probably shake about 20 minutes out of it. I know everyone says that, like, oh, the movie could be shorter, but there could be
less. But does it work? But does it work on the same? Does it hit you on that same level? Because isn't part of the movie this accretion of emotional moments? And if you know, I think the movie is, in a weird way, you know, we talk about it as a movie where it's a movie that the director allowed it to happen. I don't want to call it haphazard, but at the same time, it almost feels to me like a Jenga tower. If you start pulling anything out that's in there, does what comes after, does it crumble?
That is true. I'm talking about someone who's watching it, like, not on the way we're watching it, someone who, you know, saw the trailer and was like, oh, it's the funny detective movie. Because I'll tell you, I remember I went to see The Big Lebowski on opening day with my little sister, and we were the only people in the theater laughing.
Oh no.
And everybody hated The Big Lebowski for about a year, and now it's the most beloved movie of our time somehow.
You think maybe Vice will get that one day? After this,
when people thought they had to follow the plot of The Big Lebowski, they got really angry because it didn't add up to anything. If you look at the initial reviews, people are furious that, which is crazy. It means that I've never read a Raymond Chandler story before, but
it is pure Chandler. It is pure Chandler. I mean, the point is never the plot. The plot is it's like a pinball machine. It's just to fire our wayward detective forward. Amidst all these weird lights and noise.
That was the most perfectly timed movie of my life, because I'd just gone on a Chandler kick and I just finished reading all of his books, and I saw The Big Lebowski like a month and a half after that, so I was like, oh, I speak this language.
Well, something else that you noted in your excellent review, which I highly recommend everyone go read, because it really with a limited amount of space captures so much of the tone. I've tried writing about this thing and it took me like 8,000 words to get my arms around it. And you're over here like a Hemingway, just like,
here's
a couple of graphs. Well, I didn't say you're as good as Hemingway. I'm just saying you kept it short.
You're just saying, like, I'm drunk.
But you know, there's another great line that you had in your review, in which you noted, everything here is ephemeral. Emotional beats and plot points slipping in and out of focus, thematically matching a tale in which resolutions remain tantalizingly out of reach. And I think you're right. I think that structure is right for the film, because in that way, the structure of the film does really brilliantly reflect and reassert the themes of Inherent Vice, as much as the characters with their, in, you know, the back and forth with names we've never heard and characters we've never seen, and the plot do. But at the same time, that also works on such a subterranean, subconscious level that I wonder, again, because that's what I'm thinking about, if that's sometimes what is ultimately so alienating about the film, is if we do look at movies, I think most people do look at movies as more of what Magnolia is. It's a catharsis machine that we're going to walk in, and it's going to make us feel things, and we're going to know why we're feeling those things. And it's going to be, those things are going to be readily identified. This is how we feel about cancer. This is how we feel about child abuse. So all the myriad of horrible things that rear their heads in Magnolia. Whereas so much of Inherent Vice, I do think for the longest time, you're going through the movie going, well, what is this? Like, I know what my answer is, and I think I gave a very weepy version of it last week, but I think for a lot of people, can you have a catharsis in a movie whose structure, themes, and character are all kind of about the denial of any kind of catharsis or emotional release? I mean, that's ultimately, I think, what hurts the movie for people is, as you said, everything here is ephemeral. And even the movie itself is designed to be something that you can't really reach, something that you can't touch.
No, it's true. I mean, I watched it again this afternoon and I can't tell you what order anything happens.
Right. I mean, that's the thing that I think someone else, I don't think you would, and I know I wouldn't, I think someone else would issue that as a kind of criticism to the movie. But like, I actually feel like that's kind of the magic of the movie, is it does play like a high. It plays like a week that you spent with your friends really, really high. And you sit back going, no, wait, who said what to me? Like, Bigfoot said something.
The weird thing I was especially fixated on today is the stuff I laugh hardest, there's no way to explain to people why it's funny. The funniest things in this movie are, first of all, the denial of establishing shots is great, because you just start like close up on somebody's face and you don't see where they are or who they're in relation to until you're about 2 minutes into the scene.
And that's the gag. And it plays as a gag. Like, oh, this is where it is.
Like, well, you think they're in Bigfoot's office, you think he's this hotshot detective, and just look and they're in the middle of this giant area. There's like 1,000 desks and all these other cops. It's like, oh, he's not a big shot cop with an office. He's just a loser. He's talking to him at a desk.
And
that constantly recontextualizing what you're looking at. He waits so long. It's really exquisite how funny it is to just, you know, lying on the ground with the corpse, and you know you're not going to see the squad of police cars until about 40 seconds after you would in a normal film.
But that's actually kind of, I think, in keeping, since we're talking so much about how kind of structure and design meet theme and character, that I can't think of another film besides maybe Taxi Driver where the director works so hard to put you in the point of view of the main character and make you feel like the main character, to the point that I think you are meant to feel as confused as you are, because Doc is confused. Doc has no fucking clue what is going on. We actually, in the end, probably have a slightly better idea of all of the machinations of the plot than Doc does, but we're meant to feel like Doc. We're meant to be lost, and not just lost, but those scenes that you're talking about, it's almost like where Doc, where he's walked into a room not really paying attention, and it's only like a half minute to a minute in that he goes, oh shit, there's a bunch of cops standing all around me and like a dead body next to me. It makes me think of, there was that great line, I think Ebert had it when he was writing about the cinema magic of The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, where he talks about how there are shots that make no fucking sense in that movie. Like, say, in the Ecstasy of Gold sequence, when Tuco and Blondie are facing off, and then all of a sudden a shovel is thrown at them, right? and the colonel's just kind of like walks up to him. This is a guy they would have seen walking up to them for miles and miles and miles before he wrote, because this is totally flat graveyard circular terrain. They would have seen him approaching and been waiting for him for like 45 minutes. But the film, as he notes, he's like, this character doesn't exist until he literally enters the frame of the picture. Only then is he allowed to exist, and only then can the characters see him, because only then does the film acknowledge him. And I think that there is actually, probably unintentionally, something like that going on in Inherent Vice, where until the camera shows us, Doc has no fucking clue that it's there.
As he says, thinking comes later.
Yeah. What else? Thinking comes later. With maybe the exception of Clancy Sherlock, where he seems to get an idea that she's in the room before we see her. For the most part, everything is kind of a surprise to Doc visually. Even as you said, you almost get the sense when he's in at Bigfoot's desk, it takes him a minute to go, oh wow, look at all the other people sitting around here. Oh, and there's my lawyer Sanch. It's like everything is slow.
It happens in the FBI office too. You don't see like there's all the other agents in the room. You don't see.
And interestingly enough, with Joaquin's performance, he does almost seem constantly surprised when we get these bigger cuts, when we get these more establishing shots. He's kind of looking around at them as we are trying to take it in. Like, watch when he goes to Mickey Wolfman's house and how there are people walking around that he should be seeing, but he doesn't actively see them until that we see them and they're in the frame. It is kind of amazing. And, you know, I hadn't thought of that until you had mentioned it, but it does have that weird, the good, the bad, and the ugly design where it has to exist in the frame. We have to see it for Doc to be able to see it and vice versa. And again,
and the whole movie structure, like she shows up in his house. That's what starts the whole movie.
Exactly. But again, it does beg that question though. Is that something that makes a digestible film for like 80 to 90% of the people who go see it, who are looking for that catharsis machine and instead are given a movie that says, oh, by the way, did you know there's no catharsis or resolution to life? Things just kind of go on and then you die. And then they end. Isn't that interesting? Like it is kind of a movie that says, you know, it is not a movie that says, it doesn't end with a wonderful sing-along from Amy Mann. You know, it doesn't give us, you know, God only knows as we walk around a family's house, a porn house.
I always think of this story. My friend Wesley Morris, the brilliant film critic, he told, he was at a film festival and he was sitting near a bunch of executives. And I believe we haven't quite played, he won't tell name names, but I think it was around the time of Inherent Vice. And there was a studio executive saying, how did I get stuck with the Paul Thomas Anderson movie this time? And the other studio people said, it's your turn.
I've heard this. I saw this as like a blind item somewhere. I remember reading that.
Like these movies don't make money. They're not for anybody, but it's like your duty as a studio representative. Like, well, we've got to make one. We've got them here.
Imagine being the exec that has to catch Inherent Vice.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
Like, you're hoping at least you're going to catch a There Will Be Blood. He's going to be a pain in the ass, but we're going to get an Oscar campaign out of this. Okay, cool.
They kind of suffocated Inherent Vice in the crib, though. They knew there was no throwing good money after bad there.
Imagine being told, though, by the way, yeah, you're getting the infant terrible to make the movie. Oh, by the way, it's an adaptation of an author that 70% of anyone who tries stops out about page 30 with any of his works.
No, because you can see the first page, whereas Joaquin and Reese are together again from Walk the Line, and you got Brolin.
Hey, this could work. This could work. And then you actually read like page one, and it's all about how Doc is getting there's a close up. This is actually in the script. There's a close up of Doc getting a boner as Shasta is talking to him, and there's just a close up on his lap as he gets an erection. That's what that exec was looking at. Like, he turned the page thinking, okay, hey, maybe we got something here. This could, and then no, it's Doc does everything he can do to hide his boner as
Shasta. I do like the idea this is the last message of patronage, though. Like, well, it's your turn to get the PTA movie.
Oh, that poor bastard. So as I was saying, yeah. There's plenty of other things to talk about, but yeah, I feel like because today's scene is so odd and ephemeral that it's a good stopping moment to wonder, like, is that what just throws everybody off? And maybe ultimately that's what it is that this is, as much as I feel like someone like you and I, who maybe we're designed to be on this movie's wavelength, we can sit in a theater and watch this and go, oh yeah, it's about being sad. It's about things ending. It's about things coming to an end. And the movie's just taking kind of a...
We're the two guys that wouldn't stop writing about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Right?
Exactly. So we're kind of tuned into the idea of three-hour movies about middle-aged guys reckoning with things ending. But
wonder where that came from.
And I think maybe ultimately that's it. Just the fact that the movie, which I think is brilliantly... fucking brilliant. You know, we talked earlier about how it's a little haphazard and the movie has to be allowed to become itself. There is also a genius to its construction in how doggedly ephemeral it is, in that, and how by design it is set up to reflect its theme of there are some things in life you just can't get your arms around, you just can't hold. whether it's a person, whether it's a love, whether it's a country, whether it's a democracy, whether it's a family. There are some things that are just kind of achingly out of reach. They're close enough to be seen, but cannot be touched. Or if you do reach out to touch them, they break up like smoke. And I think
those beautiful flashbacks to, you know, the Neil Young song and the running, and then you.
And then what do you see?
That lot is turned into the Golden Fang. It's ugly. I assume it's a CGI construction.
It is. I mean, yeah, really, really quick. And we didn't really get into that on Ryan's episode, but what an amazing CGI shot that is. I think most of us, even with the most mega budget film in the world, you watch something like Avengers Endgame that was, you know, more money than God itself was thrown at that film. But every time I watched Thanos, I'd be like, God, that just looks so fucking fake.
Yeah, it looks like shit. Yeah.
It just looks like this just looks so bad. Speaking of a Brolin movie.
This was like if the Capitol Records building was a tooth.
But the credit where it's due to the VFX team of Inherent Vice, that building, never once do I question its reality. I know that it's fake because I've done just a sickening amount of research about this film. So I know that it's fake.
No one would build something that big.
Well, obviously, yeah. I mean, I should probably, I don't think it's like PTA's location scout just found this one random golden triangle of a building out in Lancaster. But like Jake Gyllenhaal and Zodiac, I am enough of a nut. I've been there. I've walked it door to door. I've seen the lot. So I can attest that there is no building there. But that said, that is a gorgeous bit of CGI fakery. It does look real. It has depth. It has a heft. You feel like you can touch that building. And yeah, that's kind of the film. And also very, 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 very 2020, that scene to me of just a scene in which we're all sitting around thinking about how good things used to be. And then you see this big fucking golden orange monstrosity in front of you, twisting towards the sky. Souring the American fate, or maybe the American fate was already sour and this is just the apex of it, is this fucking gold monstrosity.
Martin Short as Henry Gibson inside.
yes, as Henry Gibson. Oh, thank you for bringing his name into it. Yes, you're exactly right.
Well, there's so many, it's funny because we're watching it again, like there's so many long goodbye parallels, but it's, I mean, I think, you know, Anderson wants to be Altman, but Anderson's also a lot sweeter of a guy than Altman. Or at least he is now, than Alden was in 73, especially because you've got Doc is Philip Marlowe, but he's not a back talker. He's actually just like a sweet, regular dude. Where,
yeah.
Like Gould's Marlowe is the most shit talking prick. Yeah. Like he'll do the blackface to the cops. And then you've got Terry Lennox, Owen Wilson, obviously cast because he looks like Jim Bowden.
He does. Wow,
you're a nice character. But he didn't kill his wife. He actually loves his wife, and he's going to bring him home to her.
Wow. Well, I'm doing the Owen Wilson thing again, like I did last. Wow. Wow. But yeah, you're right. That's wow. What a good point that is. Now,
and then you've got the whole like sentencing the guy to the booby hatch plot, and then yeah. You've got instead of Henry Gibson, you've got Martin Short in this incredible Austin Powers suit.
One of the greatest costuming decisions in the history of cinema. There's a reason why
taking liberties with Martin Donovan's daughter to original Broadway cast albums.
And the lamps, the wallpaper and the lamps.
Now, can I tell you that this is a funny generational divide because I saw this movie for the first time with people like 15 years younger than me. And since we're middle-aged guys, we know this, the reigning Martin Donovan king of art house misanthropy was a brief window. If you weren't a video store clerk, I don't think you understand how much everyone from a certain era wanted to smoke cigarettes like Martin Donovan. I don't think I'd seen him in anything since the Nolan Insomnia. I'm sure he's probably on television shows. I don't watch. Yeah.
No, I think he's on TV now. Our man's moved to TV, as so many of them do.
Yeah. Well, so when you're finally here is Crocker Fenway. I lost my shit when it was him.
isn't he like the perfect avatar of kind of, no insult to our friend Donovan, but the fact that the face of utter evil and American ruination is just this kind of banal, well-dressed, well-combed white dude from Palos
Verdes. Right, but it was all set up from the Hartley movies. Like,
yeah, no, I know.
Payoff 20 years later, like, 25 years later.
As soon as Avatar of Hal Hartley movie stroll in as the face of all American evil. That said, we've been talking about ephemera and the ephemeral nature of this movie, with things being just achingly out of reach in the pot smog. We now come to what is one of Inherent Vice's most ephemeral moments, which is really saying something. Your scene today, it's really saying something. This is one of the more, what the fuck was that? Moments of the
I was whole. Actually quite honored you chose me for this one.
I felt like this was the one. I felt like your writing on Inherent Vice, and we're going to talk about where people can read that at the end of the episode. I felt like your writing on Inherent Vice most aligned with this sequence. That idea of, as you said, I'm going to quote you again. I'm just going to keep doing that. That line you wrote, everything here is ephemeral, emotional beats and plot points slipping in and out of focus, thematically matching a tale in which resolutions remain tantalizingly out of reach. And that, to me, is a lot of this sequence, is just this beautiful ephemera, things slipping in and out of focus. You know that something is there, and something has been clearly placed there for you as a viewer, but it also feels at the same time so out of reach, despite being right there. And I think that your writing really kind of captures the nature of that inherent vice. And I don't think that that is ever more underlined in bright green neon than in this sequence. So what do you say? You want to dive in? You want to watch the scene?
Let's watch it.
Yet there is no voiding time, the sea of time, the sea of memory and forgetfulness, the years of promise gone and unrecoverable, of the land almost allowed to claim its better destiny, only to have that claim jumped by evildoers known all too well, and taken instead and held hostage to the future we must live in now forever.
So who got her?
Department of Justice.
So, like, justice was served?
That's exactly right, Doc. That's exactly right.
May we trust this blessed ship is bound for some better shore, risen and redeemed, where the American fate mercifully failed to transpire.
So, what's so interesting to me about this scene is that it does play as something ephemeral, like you wrote. It's this strange minute-long tone poem at the end of the movie, and it's kicking off this prolonged epilogue that'll carry us to the credits that feels like a side exhalation. But I also think, for all of its ephemeral nature, it's a very necessary moment, because while it is so obscure and odd and sidelong, it's also, I think, a necessary moment for the film to catch its breath after the daunting density of everything that has come before now, where we finally reached the emotional and plot climax of the film, which also happens to be a surprise. You know, when you're watching the movie and Coy Harlingen is delivered back into the arms of his family, there is that moment of, oh, that's what the fuck this movie was? That's what this was. It wasn't about Wolfman, and it wasn't even about Shasta, that we were as wrong as Doc, because Doc was walking around thinking, it's not about Shasta.
Suddenly the music gets really nice. It's like the Johnny Knows music.
That's Johnny Greenwood doing a solid, saying, hey, everybody, no, it's right here. Listen to Amethyst. This is the scene. But I think it's a necessary moment for the film to allow its viewers to kind of catch their breath after everything that's come before now that the quote-unquote plot has been more or less resolved, with the exception of the, by definition, unresolvable love affair of Doc and Shasta. But in true Inherent Vice fashion, as you noted about how structure matches theme, I also think that this sequence very sneakily sums up everything. This scene tells us everything that this film is. And I know that we just heard it, but I'm going to say it again. We literally have a narrator chime in and say, there is no avoiding time, the sea of time, the sea of memory and forgetfulness, the years of promise, gone and unrecoverable, of the land almost allowed to claim its better destiny, only to have that claim jumped by evildoers known all too well and taken instead and held hostage to the future we must now live in forever. May we trust that this blessed ship is bound for some better shore, risen and redeemed, where the American fate mercifully failed to transpire. It's kind of, I think, a tribute to the obscure construction of this film that we literally have a narrator show up two scenes before the end and go, by the way, this is everything you just watched and why. And people still walk away going, what the hell was that thing about?
But well, even more so in the dialogue exchange, because you have like Joaquin like asking like, so justice was done. And then, you know, you have our attorney, Dr. Gonzo, just fluffing his quote, the most sarcastic prick imaginable. Yes, justice was done. Yeah, sure. The man who introduced moral ambiguity to the Jedi universe. You know, Benicio,
like. Oh, boy. Nice connection there. Nice connection with an Inkermann Vice guest. Clever. But I think that this scene is one of the most fucking fascinating scenes. God, you got me cursing a lot in this episode. One of the most fucking fascinating
scenes. People do that around me. It's fine.
It is one of the most fucking fascinating scenes in the film. It's only a minute long. It's split in half, where the first half is just a series of shots, of establishing shots. The establishing shots we haven't gotten throughout the film. We get here.
Well, and also look at like the smush telephoto of them walking along the cliff.
Yeah, it's what an odd choice too that Eldred made with that.
You don't use telephoto lens on a cliff like that, like unless you're really trying to.
Unless the act itself, to quote Morgan Freeman in Seven, unless the act itself has a purpose, and I'm assuming there has to be one. I still don't know what it is because Elswit will not talk about this film anymore. he won't. He straight up won't. Elswit, if you're listening, we're open for a bonus episode. Come back, talk to us.
That had to be a shit game. Like I wouldn't.
I'm not thinking I'm telling things out of school. I mean, we were in contact with him, and for a minute there, he wanted to talk, but then he was just like, I can't talk about that. I'm done with it. I'm done. But hey,
when
you know,
he finally became his own DP, I was like, okay, that's
something's going. Yeah. When you're making a DP-less film with no credit. And you're just working with the same crew minus the DP. There's maybe some bad blood there.
Well, it's just who wants to work for this guy? You know, I understand. Like he has his own thing. Like just let him go with it. Like,
I will say, if you are a cinematographer, you might get a little bored. You know, I always use this line: shooting in like you know the cream white walls of a like Pasadena breakfast nook. you know, which half the movie is kind of that. And it's not a complaint, but I mean, it does kind of lack the big American vistas of something like There Will Be Blood.
Interesting, too. I want to talk about, like, there's been this, like, shift in Anderson's work. And it became a big thing when 1917 got all bizarrely overrated for the Look Mom directing tropes. And all the guys who used to do all the awesome Steadicam shots, like, you just watch like Scorsese and Anderson movies. Nobody does those anymore. Like Spielberg doesn't do them. Scorsese doesn't do them. Anderson doesn't do them. They're all kind of just doing reverse shots now.
Well, it does seem like a weird thing where it's almost this, well, I don't have anything to prove anymore. I don't have to be a hot shot. Cause I remember if you recall, one of the, you know, we've had a few guests on who from Cigarettes and Red Vines, the definitive PTA online resource. And I remember one of the biggest news breaks they had, because I'm a nerd and I was following this shit. One of the biggest news breaks they had when Inherent Vice was filming was a production shot of this insane length of Steadicam track that was laid down across the side of a road. And at the time, it was like, this is the longest Steadicam shot that PTA has ever had. Oh my God, what is this going to be? And it turns out it's just the shot of him driving up to Channelview Estates, which is a lovely shot, but even a Steadicam shot like that is so understated in this film. I mean, we're not exactly Kubrick roaming the halls of the Overlook here. And there is something to say about that though, that I think it comes with I think we've definitely seen it as Coke Kid has matured into Weed Dad. There's that maturation and like, I don't have to do the whip pans anymore. Don't have to carry that same energy, although there are some
like the one Steadicam shot in The Irishman was the best joke in the film. It was going down the hallway of the senior center.
Yeah, but oh god, now I'm gonna get depressed. That goddamn movie. But there are some flourishes in this film. I mean, in Dr. Rudy Blatnoy, DDS's office, obviously, and in the car, right?
Yeah, when they're on cocaine, yeah.
Yeah, once Coke Kid comes back. But coming back to what I was saying, there is something so definitive about our scene today. There is something so, for lack of a better term, inherent vicey about this scene, and that it is a scene that gives us, it's a scene that gives us a passage from a narrator speaking directly to us, the audience, telling us everything that the movie is about. And I think for a lot of people, the first time through, you don't even catch this. You just miss it. And then the second half of the scene is what should be this incredibly humongous plot point. And in fact, in the book is its own chapter. But the scene that should be a massive plot point, the golden thing, the vessel that has been ferrying all this Indochinese heroin to America and ruining it, this is kind of like the Death Star. Imagine a Star Wars film in which the Death Star is blown up in like a very brief 20-second aside, while in way in the background, while Han and Chewie are just kind of walking around up front bitching about the Millennium Falcon not working.
Star Wars movie, I'd like to see. Is Ryan listening?
The message of the movie is buried in the first half of the scene, and in the second half of the scene, where we have this major, major moment that should be like, oh my God, they beat the bang. It's just kind of like PTA just kind of throws it in there, almost like a sliver.
No, it is the message in the movie, because they don't even know what agency got the boat.
Exactly. They think it's the DOJ. But that's kind of the point, and that's kind of what makes this film magical to me, and probably infuriating to so many other people, is that idea of, yeah, it's never about the thing you think it's about. And even if it is, that resolution, you're not going to get it. The movie's not going to give you the resolution. As I said in the last episode, you're going to be lucky if you get Coy Harlingen home. That's what you're going to get. The peace and the happiness that hearing the song Amethyst play in the background as he is delivered unto the family Harlingen, like Doc, that's the only catharsis.
He gets an Amex card. Come on.
He does. Although there's no indication yet that Doc actually gives it. He doesn't give him the message, at least, when they say, you know, welcome back to the fold. Doc doesn't do that. He just says, you saved your own life, now you get to live it. But like Doc, the movie says to us, you got to be happy with just getting Coy home. That's what this was all about. It wasn't about Shasta. You're not going to get that. You're not going to get the Fang. And even if the boat gets taken down, we're only going to give you like this little 30-second blip of it in kind of a montage. And we're going to move on to Bigfoot beating the shit out of your front door again. And to me, this little 60-second blip of a scene is kind of, it's this 2.5-hour movie in literally 1 minute.
Well, yeah, because the movie was already over before it started.
Already over before it started.
Which, like, you've kind of been like jerking around for 2.5 hours thinking, you know, you can fix things or change things. But now in the end, like, the bad guys won. It's all in the hands of Crocker Fenway, and you know, you get your little moments.
But those things don't mean anything if you don't take 2.5 hours to try and try and try again, and only learn that the one thing you can do is that one small thing. Maybe, you know, you're not going to bring down Nixon or the Fang, and you know, even if you catch the boat, you're not even going to be sure who gets it in the end. It's going to be like the Ark of the Covenant. We have no idea where it's going to go. And if it goes to the DOJ, aren't we under the impression at this point that all wings of justice, of American justice, are an arm of the Golden Fang itself?
Really, we've got top men working on it.
Yeah, we have top
kept picking their noses.
Top men. And yeah, haven't we learned at this point that eventually this boat will be requisitioned back to the CIA, who are running those secret drug runs from Vietnam back to America? And so nothing's been gained here. No, things have only been lost. And we get all of that. We get all of that in this little sequence. And I know that I'm way too emotionally attached to this film, just the way Sancho Smiley emotionally attached to a boat. But it kind of breaks my heart, this sequence, because it is everything. That's my speech, Sean. I just had to get that out there. This sequence does break my heart, as many do in this film.
No, and it, you know, to keep coming back to, you know, Benicio being the lawyer, but I mean, this movie is the bit in Fear and Loathing, you know, the soul of the book, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. when Hunter's not being a shit for, you know, one chapter in the entire 200 pages, where he talks about, like, you know, the moment when everything seemed possible and then the wave broke and it rolled back.
I'm not as big a fan of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, the film, as some people are, but that scene did capture the entire mood of that chapter from the book. Not that I lived in the 60s, but as anyone who's living, who was born, you know, in the 80s, you live basically in this boomer America where all of these things are so eulogized and obsessed over, and to the point where you almost feel like you lived them. And that sequence in the film does so.
Oh, they've been shoved down your throat the whole time.
Yeah, it's, I grew up on the Wonder
artists
Years.
Artists like Thompson that are like, or Stone, or like, well, by the way, it was all a big failure.
Actually, what's interesting to me about this scene is it does match something from Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, but not the film that also stars Benicio del Toro as a stoner lawyer. But it's a scene that's only in the book and not in the film. And it's the thing that kind of breaks the movie for me, because it is the point. It's the point of the book. Much in the way I feel like this sequence is one of the points of Inherent Vice. There's a scene in the book of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas where Raoul Duke, aka Hunter Thompson, and his attorney, Dr. Gonzo, aka Oscar Acosta, they're driving around Vegas, and Raoul Duke finally says, "Hey, we're here to find the American dream. We've got to find the American dream. It's what we paid here. Aren't we professionals?" And so they go driving around and they keep pulling over, asking people on the Vegas Strip, "Have you heard of the American Dream?" And people keep saying, "Yeah, I think it's down over here. You take a left over this and a right over on that." And then they find this building. They find this building that's been burnt to a crisp. It's just been totally burned down to its cinder block foundations. And I think they go to like a nearby like drive-through window or something like that to say, "Hey, you know, what happened to this building over here called the American Dream?" And the gal behind the window says, "Oh yeah, that burned down like about 4 years ago in 1967. You know, a little ham-handed, but the idea of like,
no, you know, it's that, great that, for gone. A book. It would have been terrible for a movie.
Anything in that film was, or anything in that book was great for a movie, but Gilliam. And that kind of feels like that moment.
I'd rather just watch like Benicio puking on the tourist.
Sure, sure. I mean, that's fun too. I do like big lizards. But that moment of someone just looking at the character and saying, "Oh no, you didn't hear the American Dream. It burned down 4 years ago. It's gone." In that case, it was a building. In this case, we see, you know, it's a ship, you know, that ship who, as Sortilege said, you know, may we trust that this blessed ship is bound for some better shore, risen and redeemed, where the American fate mercifully failed to transpire. And who do we see taking this ship back in? The avatars and the arbiters of that American fate. It's the DOJ. Justice was served. And there's something so...
That's not all. You got Reese Witherspoon working there. The Justice Department's not all bad.
Sure, but as you even pointed out in your review, Doc is kind of horrified at even her level of corruption. When she tells him to grow up, when he's like, "What? You're just like
grow up. That's the greatest."
You're just cracking open people's jackets whenever you feel like it. Like, he's kind of horrified by that. And that really.
Reese Witherspoon's so underrated in this movie. I mean, she just you know, two scenes. She knocks him out of the fucking park, man.
I would be. There's a few characters in this film who really deserve spinoffs. I don't want to say Brolin, because I feel like Brolin's one of those characters where he's too much of Bigfoot would be almost too much.
No, you're absolutely right.
A Penny Kimball assistant DA TV show, a two or three series TV show, just the wacky misadventures of Penny Kimball.
I'd watch that. Angry establishment lady who loves to have sex with dirty hippies.
And then, you know, like every, like once a season, Joaquin shows up, like he's, cause he's been out of town, and like he has to show up and wait 3 minutes while the audience applauds and everything, like 90s style, before he jumps into the dialogue. Yeah, we definitely, like, there's gold there. If anybody's listening.
She does nothing but these shitty TV shows now. We should get her into this one.
I want to talk a little bit. We've been talking about so much of the second half of the scene where there's actual, any kind of actual machinations of plot, which is Doc and Sanch watching the Golden Fang finally get caught and hauled in, which again, in the book, massive chapter. And in the film, it almost feels like a deleted scene, one of those deleted scene montages that PTA puts together in his bonus, the supplementary packages. But again, to reiterate that idea that this is about endings, and it's about things ending not as well as we would have hoped, and ending worse off than they began. I think a lot about the more abstract first half of this sequence, and we finally get those establishing shots that the film mostly denies us. But what do we get? We get, once again, we get the opening. We get the view from the opening of the film, the shot of Gordita Beach as seen from Doc's bungalow between those two houses on the Strand. But it's a wider shot now. It's not as close up. And in that wider view, just as you were saying, the more Doc looks, the wider the camera goes, so the more we can see. What do we see this time? There's no kids running and playing now, like they were in the opening scene of that, when we saw that same shot. There's no kids now. There's no one at all. It's empty and kind of barren. And then what do we see next? We go down to the sea, where he imagined Shasta in a boat when he was looking out the window of his bungalow with his binoculars looking for her. It's the sea where he spied the Golden Fang with Sanch that first time. It's the sea where Shasta, upon her return, walked with him. But what do we see now? It's instead of the ocean, the Pacific, being so sun-splashed and bright, like it has been every single time in this movie, it's in this odd kind of cold pastel twilight. The kids are no longer there. The sun is set. It's getting cold. It's getting dark. And for a beat that I really feel like is on some level just supposed to be a breather before we carry ourselves to the credits, maybe I'm giving it too much credit. It's kind of unfathomably dark. It's showing us that everything is coming to an end.
It's awful. There's a reason it repeats the beginning of the movie where there was all the promise, where you're like sitting down and you're like, I'm watching the new P.T. Anderson movie. and everyone said it's going to be like Airplane.
and instead, P.T.A.
When you go back to the same shot at the end of the movie that you had at the beginning. You
know, yeah, it's trouble. It's trouble. And but again, just I never find this to be a cold film, except for this is one of the few moments where I'm like, this is just fucking cold. This is some cold ass shit, to be rather gauche about it. And I'm going to keep saying it like a mantra, and I know I've made my point, but it's just, the kids are gone. The sun has gone down. Like it's as cold as just about anything I think you'll see in the PTA oeuvre, if you really think about it. He's saying, no, this is all ending badly for all of them. Like, the hope
is
gone.
This is all truth, though. I mean, he was doing it as far as, like, Boogie Nights are, you know, returning to the same physical spaces as before.
But even in Boogie Nights, there is a sense of, like, melancholic redemption. Well, I guess, I mean, you know, you could argue that.
No, there's a little picture of William Macy on the wall where he blew his head off.
So, I mean, hey, you know, there's some happiness there. But, yeah, there's something so.
He knows how to use scary. The physical. Places.
He does. And I just, I find this to be particularly haunting, and haunting also because it carries with it, as much as I said that this scene carries with it so many of the answers, it because it is so strange and oblique, it does also feel like a big question mark. And can I get even extra pretentious on you for a minute? Can I get, like, you cool with this? You ready for this?
Why not?
We're going to talk about David Mamet for a second. And I'm going to throw a way too long David Mamet quote at you, because I think it's pertinent to what the mood is in this sequence, and the mood that is being set as we approach the ending, and how much of Inherent Vice's endings, I think, create beginnings, and wonder about that. Mamet was talking recently how, when he was young, what got him into crime fiction. And he said, reading crime fiction is what I did instead of going to school. And one of the genres I read was the California novelists, Dashiell Hammett and Joseph Hansen and Raymond Chandler, who was wonderful, and then Ross McDonald. There was always something weird about the California story as opposed to the New York story, which was always about some guy trying to find himself. And Chicago noir is all about some guy trying to get ahead in the world. But the story of California seems to be the story of people who are lost and have no identity. And they find out what they thought they were wasn't really who they were. and their father wasn't their father, and their uncles were shtupping them and impersonating somebody else. And the noir films, all the guys getting out after World War II with nothing to do and no money except an idea and the Pacific Coast Highway. All California noirs, they're all the story of, well, what happens now? And that, to me, is the tone of this scene, which is, again, part of the insanity of Inherent Vice, is to have a scene that says, well, what happens now? Two scenes out from your final credits. But that's what this is to me. It's a filmmaker also saying, what happens now?
Doc is such a break from the typical California detective. He's not a shit talker. He's not Philip Marlowe. He's not the dude. Like, he's not, he doesn't sass back at anybody. And then when he has the chance, you know, to fucking walk off with all the money he wants, he just wants to help out this poor junkie sax player.
Well, give him a little credit. He does give a little back sass to Crocker Finway, but even then he stops halfway.
It's a very little bit.
He stops mid-sentence. He's like, I'm telling you, my man.
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't even think, he just lets that hang there.
No, I mean, compared to like the way, like, you know, what would have said, or even like, you know, Jeff Bridges would have put the shades on and been like, I still jerk off manually, man.
Yeah.
But, you know, you've always had these guys who operate outside of society and they're all like rebels and pricks and stuff. And the weird thing about Inherent Vice is like, no, Doc's like, he's a nice guy. He's looking out for people.
He is. In keeping with that, though, I got to stick with that mammoth idea. I think that's really in keeping with this scene, that idea of, well, what happens now? Like, what happens now? And that the fact that the film is posing that question when we have like 10 minutes left to go on our feature here is, again, part of the perversity of Inherent Vice. Is like,
the last shot does not leave me thinking things are going to work out well for this character.
Oh, don't say that. Don't say that.
A particular shaft of lighting, and
he smiles.
My favorite song from Elvis's Memphis record. I know it's a different recording, but
he smiles. He smiles at the light, Sean. He smiles. That's got to mean something, right? It's got to mean something, right? Couldn't it?
I don't think this is positive.
Jesus. Look, we're talking about endings here. We got to be happy. We have to have some hope. We have to have that. We have to have that kind of that. Don't we have to have that little PTA bit of hope that, like, you're driving hell. Give it this. In the book, he's driving away by himself.
Yeah.
He's driving away by himself. This time around, he's got Shasta Fey. And while this
is he really? Not- I mean, I know there's like, you know, it's like a stupid thing. You can make arguments the whole time out of who exists or not. But there's a whole theory that she only physically exists in the first scene and then never comes back for the rest of the movie. And
There's an argument to be made for that, sure. And we've kind of touched on that. I used to wonder about that in terms of the sex scene, just given its oddness, the tonal oddness. I now actually think that is indeed Shasta in that sequence. That said,
no, I do too. I mean, I know these are, least favorite discussion to have about movies.
What actually happened?
I'm going to go with what I saw.
Well, that said, the film does go out of its way to make it clear that we can't be 1,000% sure that any person around Doc is actually there at any given time. But at the same time, you got to wonder, if Doc was going to hallucinate Shasta, wouldn't he hallucinate a happier version of Shasta? He was going to imagine Shasta.
I'm not giving any credence to this theory.
Come on. Let the man have a happy ending.
He's leaving the door open enough for us to go, I don't know about any of this.
Of course, it does end with Chuck Jackson singing Any Day Now, which is basically a man knowing that his woman's going to leave him and break his heart. He's just counting down the days again. And maybe that's where things end. Maybe that's where this ends. As we've said, you know, a big theme of the film is that, as you wrote, everything is always going to remain tantalizingly out of reach for us, for these characters in life. And boy, God, we started this thing with a downer, and I get the feeling we're going to start kind of ending on a down note, aren't we? We're going to go sad again, aren't we? I don't mean to. These are kind of sad times. These are kind of weird times.
It's kind of a sad movie.
It is. It's a really fucking sad movie.
You spent months going over it in detail, but it's a little depressing.
You know, the more I've talked about it, the more harrowing is actually, I never would have thought I would have used the word harrowing to describe Inherent Vice when I started this thing like a year ago.
I had to do like an LA detective that would have gone with like the Nice Guys or something. Just because I had to talk about it every day.
Yeah, but the more I kind of live in this movie, I'm just like, God, this is a really sad story. And this is as much as I'm trying to buttress our episode right now with a glimmer of hope as we keep talking about how things are out of reach and getting colder and the children aren't running around anymore. We're in this kind of doomed pastel sunset as the last bit of hope of the American fate slides behind the mercury of the ocean. I would like to think that, you know, maybe there's a glimmer of hope, right? Right. I'm sure that, like, and hey, the election's going to go great. We got that going for us. Right. Well, if everyone could just see your face after I said that, the lights just went off in your eyes and you went dead. You went absolutely dead.
I went through this too many times.
as have these characters. And I guess that's kind of the point. But maybe this is part of the beauty of those characters, or maybe the tragedy of those characters, or maybe both, is they've been through this so many times, and yet they are willing to repeat the same mistakes, hoping that things might be different this time. That's exactly how the book ends, with Doc driving down PCH, lost in the fog, can barely see anything, but he's just hoping that something will turn out differently this time than before. And that's probably part of the tragedy of Doc, but I also wonder if that's part of what makes Doc the special character that he is, the hero that he is, the lovable character that he is that he knows how bad things are. He knows how far things are out of reach. He knows this don't mean we're getting back together. He knows the kids aren't running around anymore, and he knows it's sunset, but he's going to keep driving down PCH, and hopefully he's going to find something that wasn't there before, as unlikely as it may be. And you have to give him credit. I think you have to give PTA credit for that. Come on. If you're gonna love, if Magnolia is your favorite movie, you have
to. Yeah, no. I have to admit,
like, there's some part of you.
Narrowing window of light on Joaquin's eyes. Like, yeah. I don't care what they say during that scene. Like, the visuals tell the story for you.
Don't say that. It's a narrow beam of light, but it's still a beam of light in the darkness, Sean. It's still a beam of light in the darkness. It's still a beam of light in the darkness. That's what this movie is. And you know what? I'm going to be nice, even though you're hurting my heart. That's what you've been tonight. You didn't let me bawl my eyes out this time, which I got to say, I so appreciate.
I'm happy I didn't make you cry. Thank you so much for having me.
Before you sneak off into the night, I see you trying to do it. I see you doing it right now. I want you to do me a favor. I want you to tell everyone where they can find your stuff to read.
You can go, I write for WBUR's The Artery in Boston, or I write for a site called North Shore Movies, but I collect everything for your convenience at splicepersonality.com or my annoyingly hyperactive Twitter feed at Sean M. Burns.
There you heard it. Sean, I gotta say, thank you for, well, first, thank you for completing the prophecy of old and appearing on every single iteration of One Heat Minute Productions possible. The stars have aligned. The man goat has arisen. The sky, the moon has gone red with blood. As you have completed the prophecy as has been foretold. And Blake and I very much appreciate you doing so. Thank you for real though for coming on today and talking about this very heavy scene with me. This has been a blast. Thanks to everybody out there for listening. And please join me next time where myself and a very special guest are going to have lunch with Bigfoot Bjornsson.
So, how does this end? For Bigfoot, for Shasta, for Doc, for us, for America. Does it ever end? We'll see what we can see next time on Increment Vice.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024. Support for this podcast and the following message come from Coriant. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.